That's the Juju Orchestra with This Is Not a Tango. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, February the 26th, and a lot to talk about, so let's get started. First, look at some details. The Census Bureau has decided there will be no more Negroes. After more than 100 years, the Census Bureau will no longer be using the term Negro on its surveys and forms. Instead, the Bureau will be using the term Black or African American starting last year. You would recall that I had an extensive discussion about this very subject later last year. The first census taken in 1790 displayed only about three racial categories: free white, all other free persons, and slaves. The term Negro appeared for the first time in 1900 to identify people of African descent. The chief of the Bureau's racial statistics branch, Nicholas Jones, said census research showed that African Americans no longer identify with the term Negro. In fact, they find it offensive. Addressing the National Governors Association yesterday, President Obama warned of dire economic consequences for the states if he gets no cooperation from Republicans in dealing with the budget deficit by the March 1st deadline. Today, the president takes his Avert the Sequester tour to shipyards in Virginia to make his point about the impact of budget cuts. Here's President Obama making his case again yesterday.
These cuts do not have to happen. Congress can turn them off anytime with just a little bit of compromise. To do so, Democrats, like me, need to acknowledge that we're going to have to make modest reforms in Medicare if we want the program there for future generations and if we hope to maintain our ability to invest in critical things like education, research, and infrastructure. I've made that commitment. It's reflected in proposals I made last year and the year before that, and will be reflected in my budget, and I stand by those commitments to make the reforms for smart spending cuts. But we also need Republicans to adopt the same approach to tax reform that Speaker Boehner championed just 2 months ago. There are always going to be areas where we have some genuine disagreement here in Washington and in your respective states. But there are more areas where we can do a lot more cooperating than I think we've seen over the last several years. To do that, though, this town has to get past its obsession with focusing on the next election instead of the next generation.
Well, many governors believe the president should stop showboating and start leading. One of them is Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, a 2016 possible presidential contender. Jindal says the president should get an entirely different reaction from Republicans if he would stop blaming them for the debacle. Here's Governor Jindal.
I think it is possible to cut less than 3% of the federal budget without causing these devastating consequences. To go to the earlier question, I think you can achieve these reductions without, for example, jeopardizing children's access to vaccinations. I think you can achieve these kinds of reductions. Let's be clear. The spending in the federal budget will actually be larger even after these reductions than it was last year. So I think there is a responsible way to cut less than 3% of the federal budget. I think it's time for the president to show leadership. I think it's time for him to send to Congress a prioritized list of reductions that preserves critical services. Every governor here has had to balance their budgets during tough economic times. Every family out there has to balance their budget, isn't allowed to spend more than they need. Every business has had to become more efficient, tighten their belt. The reality is it can be done. This administration has an insatiable appetite for new revenues.
A deeply divided Senate is expected to vote today to move ahead with the nomination of Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense. The fact that Leon Panetta, The resigning defense secretary awaits the news at his California home today is perhaps a sign that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has blocked Hagel's appointment, will refer it for a vote by the full Senate. So we watch that development today. And now we want to talk about a very serious topic of cholera and its impact in Haiti. By the way, a small earthquake shook Haiti's capital yesterday, causing people to scramble. The geological survey said the quake registered a 3.5, but was relatively shallow. It was nothing like the 7.0 magnitude monster that struck the southern part of the country on January the 12th, 2010, and killed an estimated 316,000 people, injured about 300,000, and left more than a million homeless. But that's an interesting year, 2010, because on the heels of that experience comes another tragedy, a cholera epidemic, which my guest says originated with UN-supervised foreign workers. Elizy Danto, formerly well-known artistic person herself, is founder and president of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, a network of lawyers, scholars, journalists, concerned individuals, and grassroots organizations and activists dedicated to institutionalizing the rule of law and protecting the civil and cultural rights of Haitians at home and abroad. She joins us now. Elizy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, this is a major issue. The Centers for Disease Control basically affirms that as of December the 1st, 2012, there were 635,980 cases and 7,912 deaths associated with the cholera epidemic in Haiti. And I'm sure that the figures have gone way beyond that by now. What started this?
According to the UN's own investigation, and according to right now, well, actually, President Clinton, who is the UN special envoy to Haiti, has acknowledged that the Nepalese soldiers brought in the cholera to Haiti that infected and killed the amount of people you just mentioned.
That's soldiers from Nepal,
correct? The soldiers from Nepal, yes.
Okay. How did that happen?
Well, there are, since 2004, a contingent called MINISTA. It's a UN mission that was sent to Haiti to supposedly stabilize Haiti after the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat that took out President Aristide. And really, the UN mission has been a partisan force. It's an occupation force. The U.S. basically outsourced its military occupation of Haiti because that's just easier to cloak their occupation. It's less controversial a facade. But there's no doubt, for instance, former ambassador to Haiti, Janet Sanderson, basically said that for the U.S., the U.N. mission is an indispensable tool and realizing core U.S. government interests in Haiti. So that's really what it is. Now, right after the earthquake, the U.N. troops come from all sorts of countries, basically countries the United States want to owe something to. They give them jobs in Haiti. For instance, in, I think it was 2010, the amount of money the U.N. troops were making were approximately reported to be $850 million. That's what they were making for their occupation in a country that's not at war. And they have a Chapter 7 UN mission occupation, which means they can actually use deadly force against the Haitian people when we're not at war. Normally, a peace enforcement mission like that, Chapter 7, is defined as a mission that goes in to a war zone and there's a peace agreement, and they arbiter that. But Haiti has never been a war, and the rebels, so-called, that took down President Aristide were working for the U.S. and the coup d'etat people. So this is where we are. And so what happened was the soldiers rotate, and they are at every little village and hamlet in Haiti. There are about, before the earthquake, there was about 9,000 U.N. troops in Haiti. After the earthquake, it went up to over 12,000. I think they've brought it down a few thousand now. And the Nepal soldiers have been in this place called Mille Vallées, and they have about three different barracks. If you go to the beginning of Mille Vallées, there's a barrack, a place where the Nepal soldiers, now these are farming people in the rural areas, but they've just taken over all of Haiti. They're in every little hamlet, and they're well known for one thing: killing Haitian people and sexually molesting the people of Haiti, because they have not provided any security for the people. We've been worse off. So there was a change of the guard in the Nepalese contingent. Every 6 months, they rotate to different soldiers from various countries. And so Nepal is a country where they have cholera, and cholera over there is like a pandemic. They've had it for decades and decades. The people have, immunity to it because they've developed that. But during that cholera outbreak was when they made the switch for the six-month rotation and brought in soldiers that had not been tested, that were not they were not disease-free. But what's worse is that those soldiers had septic tanks for their toilets. And for a long time, they had been doing this since they got to Haiti. And this is not just, but in this time, Haiti got the disease, got the cholera disease. And the cholera, the DNA of the cholera that Haitians have is from Nepal.
Let me ask you this. It has taken, I'm sure, because you did say that the soldiers are everywhere and they come to Haiti on a rotating basis, but 635,980 documented cases, as per the Centers for Disease Control, says that something went wrong unless the idea was that nobody cared about it, but a disease to take such a incredibly heavy toll, infecting that many people and also accounting for the deaths of almost 8,000 as of December the 31st last year. Insofar as these soldiers were under the supervision, if you will, of the United Nations with respect to their mission in Haiti, what was the interaction with the United Nations on this question, or any other world authority that had anything to do with the rescue efforts in Haiti?
Well, as soon as Haitians started to have this disease, it was something that had never happened in Haiti before. We are a country that have floods, hurricanes, and cholera is a waterborne disease, and it comes from the contaminated fecal matter that you drink in your water system or in your food. So what happened was there are pictures that folks who are interested in looking can see. There's an Al Jazeera video out right now because the UN has just come out, and all again after almost 2.25 years. This happened in October 2010. To this day, the UN keeps denying liability. So, and that has had, that's one of the reasons why the situation has been exacerbated, because the stereotype is that Haitians are diseased. And so naturally, the world believes that we had cholera, and it was the disease Haitians. But it was the UN that brought it in. But the UN benefited from the stereotypes of, you know, black, the violent, diseased people that they have to put in check. And yet it is the UN who is doing the killing. It's the UN who is responsible for the death of 8,000 people in, you know, less than 2 years, and then the death, the infection of a great many percentage of the population. So because we have a population of 10 million in Haiti.
I want to ask you about the efforts you're making on the legal front. You're the founder and president of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, and you have attempted to tackle the question on the legal front. So could you answer the question about what is it that you're trying to do on the legal end, and what do you understand the health end, the response to have been so far?
The response has been really awful. It's as if black life and Haitian life means zilch. I mean, the world should know that a contaminable disease that's never been in this form, this virulent, Haiti went from zero cholera cases to the world's biggest outbreak. That's on top of 320,000 people dying from the earthquake in 33 seconds. That's on top of the, you know, Obama administration not sending us 20,000 doctors, but 20,000 troops to keep the people in line when their limbs were crushed. So Haiti is suffering just unfathomably. We are a very small Haiti-led, Haiti capacity-building organization that I was formerly the lawyer of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was the last constitutionally elected government when Haiti was free. Since 2004, his political party has not been allowed to participate in elections, and we have been under occupation. When the cholera outbreak started, we are pretty much a big voice for Haitians that they have no voice. And so the Mirebalais mayor and the people in Mirebalais contacted us and said, you have got to tell the world that the disease of the Nepalese is killing us. The hospitals were so filled with people, there was no way to put them in. It was just an amazing, awful situation. And this was happening outside of the earthquake epicenter. This was happening in a rural area up north in Haiti, where so you had the earthquake in the south, and now you have this world catastrophe in the north brought to us by those who are supposed to be protecting us. So we immediately started trying to figure out what courts go to get injunctive relief. We said that we need to the UN, because, you know, the government in Haiti is an occupied government sanctioned by the occupiers. They're not representing the Haiti people. We looked for laws that would provide us with the opportunity to go into a court and ask for injunctive relief. And what we wanted was to first stop the killings and be assured and guaranteed, get a court order that would say that the UN has taken steps to quarantine its soldiers that are diseased and to not bring into Haiti soldiers that are carrying any diseases. Unfortunately, we couldn't find a deep pocket partner to come with us. And since October 2010, We've prepared a lawsuit against the UN, but it's a very complicated situation because what happens is that there are two sides. You know, just like in America, there's this the Democrats and the Republicans. In Haiti, there are the coup d'état white folks, and then there are the so-called progressive white folks. They both work for the same precinct. And they place, you know, arsonist environment. And so what the white boys went to do, what the foreigners went to do that are progressive, is sort of sabotage our case to go to the UN directly to ask the UN to declare itself guilty. And so
well,
recently,
I don't know that you would call them white boys. I think you would call them lawyers. Let me ask you, what can people do? How do they respond in a way that would assist the cause of getting this problem taken up at the UN level or at somewhere where it makes a difference?
Well, I would urge folks if to want to know more about the situation. You know, I was born in Haiti and raised in America, and I have faced white boys my whole entire life. And I don't retract that statement. I say basically those who really want, because I have been dealing for 20 years now, with imperialism and the fake false charity of the NGOs. And it is, you know, a person of white privilege will come to Haiti with no experience whatsoever, like Sean Penn, and within a year or 2 years, they're at Harvard giving speeches on Haiti. And it is racism, and I put a name to it. There are, on my network, we reach about 3 million people. We have a very small voice, but a great portion of that are white men and women who understand the problem and who stand with us, with the Haitian lawyers' leadership, with the Ezeli Danto voice, because, you know, they know and acknowledge that imperialism and racism plays an important part on how Haiti's being oppressed.
There is no question about that. There is no question about that. None at all.
That's where I'm coming from. So I would urge those who want to help us, because as I said, you know, when 8,000 people die and folks decide to go to the UN, folks with lots of conflict of interest, and the UN, and they filed a demand letter basically, and the thing about Haiti is that it's a cash cow for people to raise money. So that's why, you know, recently the New York Times said, you know, for the earthquake, for instance, people raised, Americans really, truly, were horrified by the pictures they were seeing in the television. So one out of every household actually gave to Haiti. They have reported that the money given to Haiti was like about $7.5 billion, both in donor funds and in private funds. What I want Americans to truly understand is that, and I know that we're starting to understand it because of what happened in Katrina and what's happening now with Sandy over in New York, that those who say that they are a charitable organization have no accountability to the donors that are giving the money. And so a lot of that money stayed in the U.S. A lot of the money is paying executive salaries for the Red Cross. And, you know, less than 1 cent of every dollar goes to the Haitian government. And so
Lizzie, I don't want to cut you short because this is a very important issue and we need to really give you the room to stretch out and explain it. But we do have another segment I want to get to. I want to promise you this. I will return with you on the subject. This is very, very important to lay out so that people can follow intimately the details and therefore they would have the information they need in order to be of maximum help to you and to others who are engaged in the struggle. So I want to thank you so much for broaching the subject with us today. It certainly is not the end of the subject. It is the beginning. We will try to follow this up before too long, in another couple of days or so, and we will come back to it and lay out some aspects of it. I know, because you're so passionate about it, there's so much to learn from you about this particular situation, but it is enough that we appreciate today that we got out the fact that it is a huge problem and it has been ignored and it needs to be solved. It needs to be paid attention to. And as a community, we can play a role in supporting your efforts and the efforts of others trying to solve this problem. But I want to thank you for allowing us this time to broach us on the larger picture. And I promise we will get back to you and get into the details a bit more, perhaps later on this week or early next week. All right.
I truly appreciate it. And you might want to tell people what our website is so they can actually go read things to keep up. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks so much. All right. It's a mind-boggling. We'll come back right after this. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're now going to our second subject for the day, and it concerns the case that the U.S. Supreme Court is to hear tomorrow, to review tomorrow. It is innocuously termed Shelby County versus Holder. But this particular case will be watched by many, many people, especially those in the voting rights world, one of whom joins me now. Gerald Hebert is the executive director and director of litigation at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. From 1973 to 94, he served in a number of supervisory positions at the U.S. Department of Justice, including as the lead attorney in many voting rights and redistricting lawsuits, and as chief trial counsel in more than 100 voting rights lawsuits. In 94, he went into private practice, specializing in election law and redistricting. He has authored a number of law journal articles, and other publications on redistricting and the Voting Rights Act. And Jerry, I imagine you will be following this very, very closely tomorrow.
Yes, and thank you for having me on the program. And I will be in the courtroom tomorrow morning when the Supreme Court takes up the case you mentioned, Shelby County, Alabama versus Eric Holder.
What is the significance of this case?
This is a case in which a county in Alabama challenges the constitutionality of a important central provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 called Section 5. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was enacted by Congress largely to stem the wide-ranging and deep-rooted racially discriminatory voting practices that were rampant at the time the act got passed. It requires that only certain jurisdictions with a long history of discrimination in voting, that they have to get approval from the federal government, either the Justice Department in Washington or a special court in Washington, D.C., of any voting change that they make that affects voters in any way. And they can't implement any voting changes, whether it's a redistricting plan or whether it's a just a moving of a polling place, until they get this approval, which is known as preclearance. And so over the years, from 1965 to the present, some 16 states are currently covered in whole or in part and are required to make these submissions to the Justice Department or the D.C. court to get approval before they can do them. And Shelby County claims that the Voting Rights Act is no longer needed, that the South has largely changed, and that preclearance approval or these pre-approval requirements are unconstitutional.
Now, on the one hand, one can say, yes, that you could see that this is a safeguard, but essentially I think what the states are arguing is that this is also an incursion on the rights of the states to determine what's best for them.
That's correct. That's known as a federalism argument, and they argue that the states have a right to run their own elections and that the Voting Rights Act is an intrusion into the states' rights to govern their own voting and election processes. One of the things that has become very important in the case is that there's actually a provision of the Voting Rights Act that says that if you are subject to these special rules of preclearance or preapproval and you don't want those rules to apply to you anymore, you can seek an exemption, and it's known as a bailout under the Voting Rights Act. And if you can show that for the last 10 years you haven't been discriminating in your voting practices and that you've adhered to the requirements of the Voting Rights Act, then you can exempt yourself from these pre-approval requirements. And a lot of jurisdictions have done so, you know, especially in recent years. And so one of the arguments being made on the other side of the argument that this invades states' rights is that if the state or the county or the city doesn't like it, they can exempt themselves by seeking a bailout. And many have, as I said, have done so.
Well, you yourself have argued many cases that ultimately were decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. If you were to be a presenter in the court tomorrow, what would your particular argument be?
Well, first of all, one of the arguments I would make is that when Congress reenacted the Voting Rights Act in 2006 and extended it, these requirements of, for preclearance, that Congress gathered a record of tens of thousands of pages of testimony and examples of how the Voting Rights Act and the preclearance requirements were still very much needed. And no one really contests that the record that Congress assembled in 2006 to justify the continued extension of the Voting Rights Act was in any way, nobody could really seriously argue that that record is incomplete or insubstantial. As I say, it contained thousands of pages of testimony and examples of case after case of where the Voting Rights Act actually stopped racially discriminatory voting practices. So that would be certainly one point to make. The other point I would make is certainly that, as we have seen in just the last couple of years, the Voting Rights Act, particularly the Section 5 preclearance requirement, have actually stepped in and blocked racially discriminatory voting practices and procedures from going into effect. For example, in Texas, Texas enacted a redistricting plan for its Congress, its House, and its state Senate. And those plans went to a federal court in Washington, D.C. for approval, and the court there found, three federal judges found unanimously that Texas's plans were infected with a racially discriminatory intent against minority voters, blacks and Latinos. And then Texas passed a voter ID bill, and they submitted that to the federal court in Washington, D.C. for approval. And that failed because the court found it would have a discriminatory impact on minority voters. South Carolina tried to pass a photo ID law, and when they submitted it to the federal court in Washington, they essentially had to change their entire bill while in front of the court in order to get the court to approve it. And they changed it so radically that they don't even have a photo ID requirement anymore as part of the bill, because it was going to have a discriminatory impact on minorities. So they changed it. The state of Florida tried to close early voting sites. And again, Section 5 preclearance required Florida to submit the closing of those early voting sites in a federal court in Washington. Disapproved it under the Voting Rights Act. So the Voting Rights Act, just in the last couple of years, we can see that racial discrimination in voting is not a thing of the past. It remains a persistent problem in certain parts of the country, and without it, millions of eligible American citizens will essentially lose their voting rights.
One of the arguments that is made, and I'm not so clear about the application here, of both the 14th and 15th Amendments. How do these amendments factor into this discussion on voting rights?
Well, they factor into the discussion in a very significant way. Under the 14th and 15th Amendments, and the 14th Amendment essentially is the Equal Protection Amendment and also known as part of the Civil War Reconstruction Amendments, you have the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery. You have the 14th Amendment, which was an equal protection. We're all entitled to equal protection of the laws. And the 15th Amendment was that the right to vote cannot be denied or abridged on account of race or color. When Congress enacted the Voting Rights Act originally in 1965, and when it subsequently reauthorized the act several times thereafter, including most recently in 2006, Congress stated that it was enacting the legislation, the Voting Rights Act, again, using its enforcement power under the 14th and 15th Amendments. Those amendments say that in order to give equal protection of the laws, and in order in the 15th Amendment to make sure that no person is denied the right to vote on account of race or color, that Congress can enact what's called, quote, appropriate legislation, close quote. And when the Voting Rights Act was first passed in 1965, South Carolina went to the Supreme Court in 1966 and said, we think the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional because Congress has exceeded its authority under the 14th and 15th Amendments, and that it is not appropriate legislation. The Supreme Court rejected that. Years later, Rome, Georgia tried to get the Supreme Court to say that Congress had exceeded its authority, and the Supreme Court again rejected the argument. And then a case out of California a few years later tried the same thing, and again the court indicated that the act was constitutional and that Congress had acted appropriately. So that argument is back before the court. It's the arguments haven't changed that much, but the court has changed. And so different justices on the court may well reach a different result. I certainly hope, and I don't think they will, but they shouldn't have really taken the case in the first place, in my view.
A puzzling piece to this Voting Rights Act for me is what you just said, the word reauthorization. Why doesn't act? Why isn't it just permanent? Why does it have to be tinkered with every now and then and reauthorized? What is the unique nature of this act that it just can't be?
That's a very good question, and actually the answer also leads to why the Voting Rights Act is constitutional. When Congress first passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, some of the provisions are permanent, and they don't have to be reauthorized. But Congress felt, and I'll give you one example. The Voting Rights Act has a provision that it calls Section 2 that says that if anybody in the country, no matter where they are, if a local government or a state government enacts a voting system or moves a polling place or does something, it draws a redistricting plan, and it produces discriminatory results, then they can be sued in federal court. And, you know, plaintiffs can go into court and file a lawsuit and try to get it declared illegal. That's permanent. That applies nationwide. Section 5, as I said earlier, only applies to all or parts of 16 states. And when Congress passed Section 5 and said, we're going to make Section 5 only apply to certain places with a long history of discrimination, and we're going to have a formula that determines that, and they set that forth in the law, they said, well, look, this is a pretty substantial intrusion of the federal government into the affairs of the states. So we're going to make it temporary. And we're going to make it temporary in the sense that we'll only enact it for a five-year period in 1965, and we'll revisit this 5 years later to see if it's still needed. Well, of course, 5 years later, not much progress had really been made in the voting rights field with regard to state and local governments, so Congress extended it again for 5 years. In 1975, they took another look, and they enacted it this time for 7 years because they wanted to get past the next census and the next round of redistricting. So in 1982, Congress took it up again and assembled a massive record, just like they did in 2006. And they found that, again, despite these preclearance requirements, that a lot of the jurisdictions were not following the law and were continuing to discriminate. So they extended it in 1982 for 25 years. And so come 2006, Congress took the act up again with about a year left for preclearance. They again assembled a massive record of continued need for the Voting Rights Act. But they made clear that if jurisdictions wanted to get out from under these requirements, they could exempt themselves. So they extended it for 25 more years in 2006. And the argument before the court tomorrow will be whether Congress improperly and unconstitutionally extended the act when it did in 2006.
Well, this then raises a fundamental question. It's no longer just about the rights of the states and their adherence to constitutional law and even to the act itself and its various provisions. From the point of view of a citizen, a member of the class, of any of these that pertains to any of these sections that pertain to this their class, I wouldn't this very argument kind of diminishes me, let's just say, as an African American. I feel somewhat diminished by an act that is conditional, of which I have no say, no direct say. So what is the provision for citizens to articulate that these acts somehow should have sort of reflect the concerns of citizens, because it gives a very uneasy feeling that your rights are totally conditional and it can go one way or the other without your knowledge or approval?
Well, let's just say first that it is clear that over the last five or so decades that we've made immense progress in protecting and expanding the right to vote. And we've done so thanks in large part to the Voting Rights Act itself. Now, in the preclearance process, this pre-approval process I mentioned, that's really before the court tomorrow, the constitutionality of that, when there's a voting change that takes place in your community and you want to be heard about that voting change, whether it's changing the hours that they have for voter registration or maybe where you're going to be allowed to go cast a ballot. Let's say that they move it from the community center in the middle of the black community to an all-white club. The polling place is moved to a club that is private and only allows white people in it. Well, you obviously, as an African American, would want to object to that. And so you can actually call up the Justice Department and say, hey, my county is trying to move a polling place, and here are the facts, and I think this is discriminatory. And so you have that kind of access right now that will be lost if Section 5 is declared unconstitutional. And instead, what would happen would be that if that happens in your community and you don't have Section 5, then you have to hire a lawyer who will go into federal court and file a lawsuit and hopefully prevail. And if they don't prevail, it'll cost a lot of money and you will be out of luck. And so the Voting Rights Act, by forcing these states and counties and cities with a long history of discrimination to actually get approval first, and in a process that allows local citizens to really weigh in on the voting changes, is extremely important in safeguarding the right to vote.
Well, there's no wonder that you were a very, very good law professor at Georgetown and American University and the University of Virginia School of Law. You've done a fantastic clinic for us today. I'd like to call you back right after the Supreme Court hearing at some point soon after that, and you could tell us from your vantage point what the gains were or the losses were.
I'd be happy to do that, and it's a privilege for me to be on your show.
Oh, not at all. Thank you so much, Jerry. Thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, that was a primer in the Voting Rights Act, and I'm hoping that we had an opportunity to learn some of the, you know, the ins and outs of things. Sometimes it takes somebody like that just to conduct a little class, and you sit down and you listen and you take notes and you learn. But he'll be back, and we'll do a more thorough analysis of the decision. It probably would not come for months and months and months, but he would be able to tell us what went on in the Supreme Court, because he'll be there tomorrow. I also want to thank you for your patience. I didn't leave room for questions today because I was more interested in the information coming to us. Now, we will return to the question on Haiti and the cholera. This is a huge, huge story. We will have to reexamine that, and I'm sure Elize will be with us again. We'll make that arrangement, and we'll get back to the topic also about the Voting Rights Act. I want to thank you. I mean, I'm so incredibly impressed with the audience of this show. You folks are just the best. You're just the greatest. You're the best. I always say that. You're the best, best, best people. I am delighted with the responses I'm getting on my Facebook page. I'm just floored by the whole thing, and I'm discovering and rediscovering people. We kind of lost touch there for a minute, but we're getting back together. It's a wonderful feeling. It's a great family reunion on the Facebook page. You may want to visit it. And tell your friends. The main thing is we are growing this audience, not just for this show, but we're growing PRN's audience. And the intention is to provide on a wider scale, as wide a scale as we possibly can get, an entirely different point of view. And your assistance is greatly appreciated. Coming up next is Economic Update with Richard Wolff. And, of course, you can continue the discussion with me on Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. I am delighted and honored and privileged to be in your company today. Thank you, and we meet each other again tomorrow at 1 o'clock right here. Thanks so much for listening.